Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mick Wall and Joel McIver present Dead Rock Stars.
If you want to hear more about Denzel the Dragon, Hard and Heavy, the world's first video magazine, and the afternoon Ronnie James Dio first revealed the Devil's Horns, then please stay right here for Dead Rock Stars, the podcast that refreshes the parts other podcasts cannot reach when it comes to heavy rock
music. Do you
music.
Actually write this stuff before we begin?
I've been awake all night trying to think of it.
The show that refreshes the other parts. Well, this places us in about 1985 on the Steve Wright show.
That's where I'm happiest, Mick. And what I was going to go on to say was that my name is Joel McIver. Let's talk about me for a bit. And it's relevant to today's podcast because the number of fucking people that come up to me and sing Holy Diver at me because it rhymes with Joel McIver is high and significant.
I never knew that.
Bastards.
I've never seen anyone do that.
No, they do it, believe me. They write it at me in emails and Facebook.
Holy Diver?
Yeah, because it sounds a bit like my name, right?
They don't do it because you look like Jack Black.
Well, one day I hope to look like Jack Black. Anyway, look, so my name is Joel McIver, as I've just said. I'm the author of many books on various kinds of music, but my achievements are eclipsed many times by my colleague sitting next to me now, my comrade in arms, the man who not only puts the wall in
Adrian's wall,
he puts the Mick in micturation.
I put the sausage in your ice cream.
No, that I did work on, the Mick in micturation. How are you today, Mick? Are you well?
Yeah, I don't even know what that means.
I was hoping
I was feeling good till you came out with that, you know.
It's a great compliment.
Is it?
Yeah, I was hoping you wouldn't know what micturation was.
I have no idea what that means. Is it something to do with, you know, onanism?
It's not unrelated, but it's a good thing.
Okay.
You know, it's something that we all do on a regular basis.
You speak for yourself, big boy.
Now listen, this is episode 2 of Dead Rock Stars, in which Mick and I talk about and celebrate the lives of great musicians no longer with us, or less great, as the case may be. Our first episode, which we're trusting that you all heard and enjoyed, was on the great Lemmy, sadly no longer with us for the 2.5 years and so on. And today we move on to a rock star of, I would think, equal stature, would you say, Mick? In terms of his cultural impact, in terms of the music we love him for?
Globally more so, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think the cult of Lemmy is narrower. For instance, we don't talk of the mighty Lemmy, but we do talk of the mighty Dio.
Mighty lunged.
I think that's a distinction worth making.
Absolutely it is. So, yes, as Mick has said, today we're talking about the great Ronnie James Dio. It was awful when Ronnie died in 2010, in his late 60s, possibly a decade before his time.
Or if you actually get his real birth certificate, possibly 2 decades.
Right, now, there was always a lack of understanding about that, wasn't there? He was either born in 49 or 42 or 47 or, you know, some of these far-off dates that were never quite clarified.
Well, let me put it this way. I don't imagine for one second Ronnie changed his date of birth to seem older.
No. He was a senior citizen among us, was he not? Always. He was a senior one of us.
Well, I tell you what, I do think he'd lived many lifetimes. I mean, not just in bands, which he had, but when I first met him in Black Sabbath, I was their PR in those days.
Yeah.
And he already seemed to me, I honestly mean this in a very kind of admirable way.
Admiring?
He seemed already to me about 100 years old. I mean, he really was kind of Tolkien-esque.
Sort of in wisdom, kind of.
In wisdom, also just in a shell in terms of many layers of the onion. You know,
this is amazing.
Many lifetimes. Yeah. Because he's one of the toughest guys I ever worked for. And yet at the same time, clearly very poetic, romantic, you know, remarkably yeah. romantic. But at the same time, you know, you've got this hard-boiled New Yorker.
Yeah.
But as I say, quite mystical too.
See, this is brilliant. This is exactly what I wanted to kick off with. The reason why I think people listen to our podcast is because we knew these people, right? And they want to know what these people were really like.
Yeah.
So what you've said instantly makes it very clear that this was no ordinary man, right? I mean, he had layers of, I don't know, being, right? Are we saying that?
Well, when I first met Black Sabbath, Ozzy had been sacked and Ronnie had been brought in and they'd recorded the Heaven and Hell album yeah. in America, but they were now mixing it in Paris with Martin Birch,
yeah.
who then went on to Iron Maiden and so forth. And I was a young 21-year-old PR.
Lothario.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Did you have a mullet at this point? I think it's important in every episode to ascertain the status of your mullet.
Well, this is late 79, 1980, so less of a mullet and more of a, you know, hair means something, man. You know, don't mess with my hair. Do not touch my brush.
That's it. That's it.
Don't even come near
my do.
My do.
Don't mess with my do. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I needed to make that clear.
Yeah.
So you walked into the studio where they were mixing.
Yes. And I met three grizzled veterans, Tony Iommi, Geezer Butler and Bill Ward. Bill Ward, who was, as I'm sure he'd have no problem admitting to now, was a complete
yeah,
mess.
He has,
I mean,
done many times.
I have a
this, yeah.
lovely story about him that we may or may not tell, which involves nudity. Ooh. But Ronnie was different. The other three I kind of got straight away. You know, they'd had their big days.
Yeah.
Ozzy had left. This was a very kind of crucial moment for them. But they felt very confident, very confident. Ronnie, I didn't know what planet he was from at all.
Yeah.
He kind of beamed into the room and immediately the atmosphere changed. He was full on. I mean, he could be an incredibly nice, generous, warm, giving guy, very welcoming, hospitable, but he was as hard as a rock. He wanted things to go to plan. I think at that particular moment, because he was filling Ozzy's boots,
yeah.
as it were.
Yeah.
And in those days, we have to remember, this was a big deal. It's not like now where, you know, Paul Rodgers can sing with Queen
yeah.
and
Journey can pull in some unknown singer and all that.
Right. Lou Reed can work with Metallica
oh, okay. yeah.
or whoever it might be. You know, yeah. different versions of Bad Company and Foreigner. Back then, authenticity was the key. And I think Ronnie was extremely aware that he had a big task ahead of him. But I got the feeling it went beyond that. I felt as if he'd spent his life trying to validate who he was, what he was, and how it was going to be, you know, his vision for how things got done.
That's amazing. Now, I know from what the other members of Sabbath have said, of that iteration of Sabbath, that he came in and he was musically trained, which really helped them because Ozzy had not been. He was able to take part in the arrangements of the songs. Obviously, his vocal skills were unearthly. I mean, that's the thing he's remembered for. Coming at this from an outside point of view, you might, if you were uninformed, sort of think of Ronnie as this kind of laughable guy who slew the dragon as part of the Dio shows, you know, and did all this kind of cliche heavy metal stuff. This hard edge you're talking about, was it an authority? Was it a no one fucks with me kind of thing? Or
both of those and more.
Yeah.
Now, I am not a tall person, you know, by any stretch of the imagination. But I was a little bit taller than Ronnie, and I hate to resort to that cliche of small man syndrome because I think that would be far too easy and wouldn't really explain what was going on with Ronnie. But he certainly wanted you to know he was in the room. He was a huge personality.
Not in an obnoxious way.
Sometimes,
yeah.
I mean, in those days I was working with Thin Lizzy, who were good times all the time, you know. I worked with Journey, who were a bit uptight, but at the same time, you know, they like to chill out in the usual Californian weed and wine way.
Yeah.
Ronnie was, you know, I remember taking him, I got him on the cover of Record Mirror magazine. And for those that are way, way too young to recall, Record Mirror in the early 80s was one of the four principal music weekly magazines.
The other three being Sounds, Melody Maker and The Great Enemy.
Yep. But Record Mirror was the only one with a colour cover.
Right.
And Record Mirror was a pop magazine. Mm, and the fact that we'd got Black Sabbath on the cover in colour was considered, you know, quite a coup.
Yeah.
And I remember going backstage at the Hammersmith Odeon and carrying, you know, a dozen of these on my arm, you know, like war medals, and handing them out. And Ronnie sat down, he got his reading glasses on, he sat down, he read every single word because it was his picture on the cover, it was his interview.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, he was like, "Have you read this? Have you fucking read this?"
Great.
I was like,
yeah,
it's great. He went, "Great, great, see here." And he shows me like one line where it didn't say Ronnie James Dio is an egomaniac. It said something like, you know, with the maniacal ego of a rock star, or, you know, something like that. This asshole says I'm an ego fucking maniac. What are you going to do about this?
Bloody hell.
I'm like, you're on the cover. I mean, what are we supposed to do? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. And also, I think you're micro-reading this.
Did he take that kind of positive criticism well?
No. I mean, I had to leave the dressing room shamefaced, you know. I mean, he was deeply serious. That particular Heaven and Hell tour where I went across Europe with them, yeah. I was on the road in Britain, they were the first band to take me to America.
Yeah.
I was over there staying at the Waldorf Astoria. Mm, mm. You've got Elizabeth Taylor in the next suite and Mick Jagger down the hall. And
be the premier inn nowadays.
We wouldn't even get to be a FaceTime. FaceTime with Black Sabbath.
Now, he was quite good at turning on the charm with the journalists, I think, as I recall.
He was brilliant at turning on the charm with everybody. So that sort of nasty side, I don't think Ronnie would have seen it that way. He saw that as taking care of business.
Being assertive.
He's a New Yorker.
Yeah.
Where only the ugly survive. Yeah. You know, and you have to kick some serious ass to get anywhere. And let's face it, he'd come from a tough world. I mean, he grew up as a lounge singer.
Yeah, was it Ronnie and the Red Caps?
Well, they came a little bit further down the road. Originally, he was literally a tux, bow tie, fly me to the moon.
Ronald Padovano? Did I dream that?
Yeah.
That is right.
Yeah.
You told them on research.
In fact, he told me once that he got the name Dio from a local mobster.
Yeah, it means God in Italian.
Yeah, I know. I love that. James God.
You know, why not go the whole way?
Well, if you're going to call anybody God and you like your rock and metal, he's the man. He is absolutely the man. And in fairness, you know, he gifted Black Sabbath. Some would say the greatest. I would say one of the greatest albums of their entire career.
Of course.
It was an absolute brilliant piece of work. Mm. But it was fueled by Ronnie's utter determination to establish his reputation forever.
Because he'd done Rainbow and had achieved quite a bit of recognition for that.
He was in Rainbow. He'd started out in Elf, who supported Deep Purple.
Yeah.
And then when Ritchie Blackmore left Deep Purple to form Rainbow, he invited Ronnie and a couple of the other guys from Elf to come in.
Jimmy Bain, or was that someone else?
Not Jimmy Bean. Yeah. And as Ronnie told me at least 400 times, it was always meant to be Ritchie Blackmore and Ronnie James Dio's Rainbow, which of course is a mouthful.
Yes.
You may as well say Ritchie Blackmore and someone you've never heard of's Rainbow. Mm. You know, so you can see why that didn't pan out.
But, you can.
But Ronnie held that against him. But then in fairness to Ronnie, I mean, he helped Ritchie Blackmore and Rainbow become a huge international act. I mean, when Gillan left Deep Purple, he didn't go on to become a huge international. None of them did apart from Ritchie Blackmore.
Yeah.
And he was utterly aided and abetted in that by Ronnie James Dio. But because Ronnie felt he didn't get the credit he deserved, this absolutely echoed throughout Ronnie's career to the point where when Ritchie fires him from Rainbow because he wants to go in a much more commercial direction, which he did with Graham Bonnet.
Yep.
He didn't want to sing about rainbows and dragons anymore. He wanted to sing about I Love You, You Love Me.
Yep.
What a big number one record it's going to be.
that rhymes, by the way, what you just said.
It was meant to. See, unlike your stuff that gets written down the night before and is just bloody rotten, you know.
So I knew you were a poet, of course. I'd forgotten you were a poet. Okay, good, yeah.
He gets fired. And Rainbow goes on to even greater success. I mean, this hurt a man who was very, very proud and was evenly balanced with a chip on both shoulders at this point.
Yeah.
He joins Sabbath. He almost single-handedly rescues him, because let's not forget that last Sabbath album with Ozzy, Never Say Die, was one of the worst records ever released history of worst records. You know.
The last gasp of the Aussie lineup.
Absolutely. And I think he just wanted to make sure that this time he got it right. It gnawed at him that he was following in Aussie's footsteps, because it's still going to be, oh, well, he's just hitching a ride. He hitched a ride with Blackmore. He's hitching a ride with Black Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where, this is something I really did want to mention, on that first trip to Paris, Ronnie said to me out of the blue one afternoon, he said, listen, I've been working on something. I want to show you. And he held up what we now consider to be the devil horn salute with both hands.
Mick is holding them up as we speak.
I'm holding them up as we speak.
For those watching this in black and white.
Why he came up with that, he explained to me. He said, because when Ozzy used to come out on stage, he used to flash a peace sign.
Yeah.
He'd put up two hands. In fact, you can find zillions of pictures of Ozzy in Sabbath in the 70s. Bit like Nixon on the White House lawn, you know, holding up the two...
Or like Ringo Starr does all the time.
Absolutely, except with two hands.
Right, got it.
Yeah, this goes to two hands.
The full Aussie.
See, Ringo's only one hand job. you know, this is two hands.
What you're saying is this is a double hand job.
This is a double hand job of peace and love. So, Ronnie says to me, what do you think? It's kind of like, you know...
Oh, he ran it past you. Like,
yes.
Should I do this?
Because I'm the PR, right? Should I have pictures done like this? Should I do it on stage?
God.
And
it was that contrived.
In fairness, he could have gone like that.
He's doing rude fingers, aren't
I'm
he?
Doing... Yeah, yeah. Is that index finger?
No, middle finger.
I'm doing two middle fingers now. That's two middle fingers. He could have done that and I'd have said, yeah, whatever. But he did this and I thought, oh, that's intriguing.
If you'd said, no, that's a crap idea, Ronnie, do you think he wouldn't have done it?
He wouldn't have listened to a word I said.
Because what I was angling for was you saying yes, he would have said no, therefore establishing you, Mick, as the guy who basically authorised and pioneered the horns in metal.
Let's rewind that.
Yeah.
If I'd said to Ronnie, absolutely no way, he'd have gone, Mick, you're the expert.
Thank God for letting me know.
You're the expert. You've just saved my career. I could have looked ridiculous when I went on stage.
Well, this is the truth. Listeners, you hear about it here for the very first time. Mick Waller is the man who authorised Ronnie James Dio's pioneering use of the corna, as I believe it's known in old Italian, the dual horns, which I believe come from some sort of warding off evil thing from ancient witchcraft.
But here's the thing. He didn't mention any of that to me at the time. And being of Italian descent, I mean, it may well have been in his thinking, but at that moment, and we spent a good half an hour. He walked around the hotel room. Again, I'm doing the devil horn thing with both hands.
You do that really well, Mick.
He walked around the room showing me what he would do. And he'd obviously clearly figured it all out. And I just thought, yeah, that's genius. It's like, I'm in the tradition, but I am my own man.
Yeah.
He didn't mention anything about warding off the devil, or he certainly didn't call it the devil horn salute.
Bill warding off the devil.
Yeah. He just said, this is my version of Ozzy's peace sign.
That's amazing. And so history was established.
And so it was established.
Oh, my God. All right. So Ronnie was very heavy metal. We know this. We're jumping forward a little bit. We'll come back to Sabbath. But after Sabbath, when he went on to do Dio, and as of, you know, resuming this cliche, he slew a dragon on stage. And to me, that was when heavy metal got really silly, you know. I mean, for fuck's sake, you know, pixies and trolls and dragons, you know, this is when people laughed at you for liking metal. That's my view. Does that resonate with you at all?
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I mean, I went to some of those shows and we couldn't wait for the dragon. You know, we loved it. No, well, okay, it was theatre.
Yes.
So it was a bit of pantomime, but he'd get the sword out and duel the dragon. And the dragon, this is the 80s, not now, where you've got a virtual reality dragon from Game of Thrones.
A hologram, which we'll talk about later.
Yeah, this was more like, you know, something out of, he's behind you. Two guys in a pantomime horse with a dragon's head. But listen, here's where that came from, okay? And Metallica did it.
Yeah.
Everybody had their go at it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Here's where it came from. Iron Maiden's Eddie. That's where the impetus came from, because Maiden, they didn't have this huge vision, but they came up with this idea, which turned out to be visionary, which was, instead of always having a picture of them on the cover of their albums, they would have this Eddie the Ed, which was just a very cheap mask on the stage, which blew smoke originally, but by the mid-80s had turned into this 12-foot...
Right.
pantomime mummy that would come out at the climax of their show.
And everyone loved it.
Everyone loved it. It seriously took it to another level. And of course, you didn't think, oh my God, it's a robotic futuristic mummy. You went,
it's Eddie!
You know, let's have another 5 pints.
But the point is, everyone was laughing at this, just as they would have laughed at the dragon. I'm sure he did look forward to it, but essentially you thought it was silly, didn't you?
It was Denzel the Dragon, that was his name. Did you not know that?
No.
Yeah, Denzel the... Get with it, man.
I know. I need to catch up with 1985.
You need to get on YouTube right now. Type in Dio/Denzel.
That's beautiful.
Okay. Well, Eddie the Ed, Denzel the Dragon.
I'm sorry. Now I see the link.
Right. Yeah. Okay. No, Denzel, let me tell you something, was brilliant. I mean, in fairness, I can't recall exactly whether us lot at Kerrang came up with the idea of Denzel the Dragon or Ronnie did.
Yes.
But in those days, there was such an overlap. The minute we might have written something like that in the magazine, ergo, everybody called it that.
Got it, including
Ronnie.
That was the power of Kerrang back then, of course.
Absolutely. And also, Ronnie James Dio was an extremely shrewd and astute guy.
I mean,
What are you doing? Snorting
I'm
coke?
Just, I'm just coughing away from the mic.
Yeah, I will say that. Yeah. Stay off it. Joel.
Denzel the Dragon, eh?
Stay off the stuff, for fuck's sake, when we're doing these. Here's when it got silly.
Yeah.
The following tour, when he had the spider.
Ah.
Did you never see the spider?
No. I think I tuned out at that point. That's terrible, really, isn't it?
Arnie the Arachnid.
That's not what it was called. You've retrospectively called it Arnie.
I may have done that, yes. But it was a giant spider.
Yeah, which he similarly dispatched.
He certainly did.
Of course he did. No fucking spider's going to take out what he did.
A mere gigantic spider from the future. Tis but a scratch compared to the great Dio.
Good Lord.
Yeah, at that point, I must say, we did kind of think he's jumped the shark,
right.
You might see. He's sped right over the spider there.
Yeah. Right, there you go. It's silly, isn't it? Metal got silly at this point.
But metal's allowed to be silly, isn't it?
Dead rock stars. Carpe diem, baby.
I hadn't seen him for a few years, and the first time I hooked up with him again when he was in Dio... It was like meeting a long-lost brother. He was so kind and, you know, embracing.
I mean, this was real. This was real friendship, you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Gave me his phone number and told me to come to the house and...
Well, you've got to tell me about the house.
The house, okay.
Well, let me just butt in 1 second, because I recall when you did your Monsters of Rock TV show,
there
is, it's either an entire programme or possibly just a few scenes where you're playing snooker with him at his mansion, essentially, aren't you?
Yes.
Do tell.
Well, those are just a few scenes. In fact, we did a whole programme... which in America came out on the world's first video magazine.
Jesus.
Hard and Heavy.
Hard and Heavy.
Hard and Heavy.
Hard and
the
heavy.
World's first. Hard and Heavy with your host, Mel.
Hard and Heavy.
Hard Heavy.
Snooker with Ronnie. Did you beat him at snooker?
No, of course not. I mean... If Denzel the Dragon is not going to be able to defeat the great Dio, the mighty Dio...
Nick, the wall isn't going to
win. I'm not going to beat him at snooker. Was it snooker or was it pool?
Mate, you're the one who did it. I don't know.
Who knows?
Looked like a pretty big table.
I was in his enchanted castle. I can't remember what happened. We went to his house to film.
Which was what, in LA?
I might be horribly wrong here, but it was up in the hills somewhere. Him and Stevie Nicks had not adjoining castles, but they had in the same vicinity... They did.
Was it literally decked out like a castle?
Ronnie's was, yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It was really, honestly, you came in, and here is this incredibly welcoming guy, okay? Welcoming you to his castle.
Yeah.
Okay? And you've got the kind of normalish rock star stuff where in his big kind of living room, there's a bar, you know, a fully stocked bar.
Of course, with it's de rigueur.
It's de rigueur, except it's a British bar.
Like a pub.
It's a pub, because Ronnie loved real ale and he loved Indian food, and they were the two things that were rarer than hen's teeth in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
So he had his own with the pumps and the optics, you know,
amazing.
Ronnie's.
Yeah.
Fantastic. But then he took you through the rest of the place, and literally, when I say castle slash kind of church, there was stained glass everywhere. There was at one point a lectern with a 15th century Bible
yes,
on
mate.
It.
Brilliant. There must have been a suit of armour around somewhere.
There was, but let me finish about the
lectern.
The lectern's got a 15th century Bible open on it at a certain page. There's a candle next to it, which is permanently lit.
No.
And then we go into another room, and here's the suit of armour, proper suit of armour. Again, behind it, the stained glass and the arched windows. And
was this all quite impressive, or was it deeply tacky? Or was it both?
Well... deeply tacky. I wouldn't have gone that far because, I mean, I'd been in LA for a couple of years at that point, and trust me, you have to go a lot further to go to deeply tacky in LA.
By that point, I think your sense of what was tacky has gone beyond most people's, I think, at that point.
To be honest, by LA standards, this was positively magisterial. This was operatic in its classiness.
And he took all this seriously, right? I mean, he didn't sort of laugh and say, I know it's a bit silly, but, you know,
no.
I've got the castle.
No, he explained.
He's well into it.
This Bible is from the, you know, the 14th century. Century or whatever it was.
You said 15th minute ago. Can you be consistent?
These things.
This story has gone on a while. It might have dated a century since then. Anyway, go on.
We can make fun, but at the end of the day, this was his oeuvre. You know, this was his
milieu.
His milieu. This is where he drew inspiration. And so when he was writing about neon nights and, you know, so many of the kind of mythological subjects, because he used to sit there reading this stuff. He was completely steeped in it.
It's wonderful in a way, isn't it?
It is. And I think it's interesting when you then look at, say, what Ritchie Blackmore did later in his career when he went into the whole medieval.
Yeah, of course.
which of course everybody laughed at him for. Mm. And there are many aspects of that that are hilarious to the untrained eye.
Yeah.
But at the same time, Ritchie really does know his medieval music and his instruments.
And he sells out castles in Germany, so he's got the last laugh.
He does. And he does a nice line in Mead.
Jerkins.
I beg your pardon?
Jerkins.
I think he was doing a lot of that way before the medieval phase, but I appreciate your point.
I'm so sorry about the 18-plus nature of this podcast, listeners.
No, you're not.
I'm trying to restrain my comrade here.
No, you're not.
So, would you say you knew him well? Were you friends?
I don't know. That's a big question, isn't it?
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
I mean,
Did he confide in you, you know, about his fears, insecurities, ambitions?
I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah.
I worked for Ronnie again in the mid-90s as his PR.
Well, that's interesting, because that was a bit of a dodgy period back then, wasn't it?
Angry
Machines and all that bollocks, or was that a bit later?
Well, no, that was about that time. But see, I liked those records. I thought Angry Machines was a really strong musical statement by someone who could have easily just recycled the past. I think he was urgently trying to get in touch with the same generation of metal fans that, you know, you are so familiar with, Joel, in terms of, you know, those bands that came along like Tool.
The 90s lot. When it became a bit more self-aware. But that was never going to work, surely. I mean, people weren't going to warm to Ronnie, who wore, you know, blue hair and rode skateboards to school in 1998.
Mm. Well, I don't think he rode any skateboards, in fairness. I think he'd be more probably riding a dark mare through the midnight dawn of tomorrow.
Like, you know, a dark mare.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Dead Rock Stars with Mick Wall and Joel McIver.
To circle back to the whole Rainbow thing and Ronnie's determination to establish himself. After Sabbath, which again he felt really done down by, he'd done two tremendous albums, worked on a great live album, and essentially got the boot, or more or less painted himself into a corner where he had no choice but to leave.
Well, can you clarify? Because there are conflicting stories about this. Did he leave? Was he pushed?
You know, when a marriage ends, you know, is it the first one that begins an affair, or was the marriage already dead from the neck up?
That's a very good way of fudging the actual truth.
Well, no, the actual truth is that Black Sabbath belonged to Tony Iommi, Geezer Butler, and Ronnie felt that he'd taken ownership because of Heaven and Hell and Mob Rules, two great albums.
And brought them back from
He really had.
Oblivion, really, yeah.
He brought them back from Oblivion. He brought them into the 80s. There are still people I know today who are maybe 10 years younger than me, who for them, Sabbath begins and ends with Heaven and Hell.
Yeah.
I mean, they look at the Aussie albums and they're meh.
I totally see that point of view. You know, you might think the first three or four Aussie albums are amazing, then after that tails off, and then it bounces back incredibly with Ronnie. I see that point of view.
By the time Ronnie then forms Dio, this man who'd fought so hard for Black Sabbath and before that Rainbow to be slightly more democratically run, now exerts a grip of iron, you know. I mean, he co-wrote with Vivian Campbell and Jimmy Bain, but, you know, the clue was in the name. You know, that band was called Dio, and it was Dio's band.
It was Ronnie James Dio's Dio.
To the point where, by the late 80s, and this was odd, because no one could understand why he did this, because, like I say, the clue's in the name, and they'd already had, like, three multi-platinum albums. He suddenly announces, his people suddenly announce, you know, the guards at the gate come down with the scrolls. And in future, the band is to be known as Dio, featuring Ronnie James Dio.
It's so weird, isn't it?
Well, at that point, it's almost Trumpian in the respect of thinking, why would he do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Is he so far gone that this seems to make sense to him?
No, he wasn't an overindulger in the substances, as I recall. He wouldn't have gone mental because of that, I assume.
Ronnie wasn't into cocaine or anything like that. He did like a puff.
Okay, but he wouldn't have gone like Glenn Hughes and just lost control completely.
Oh, God, no. No, no. If anything, Ronnie was the opposite end of the spectrum. He was Mr. Control.
Yeah, okay.
Completely in control. And it's almost as if, you know, this was another expression of that increasing desire to be completely in control, because as any control freak will finally break down and admit to you, if you push them enough, they're very insecure.
Yeah.
And although he had this incredible talent and he'd built this incredible career, I think there was always this underlying feeling of, you know, he has to keep the plate spinning. He can't let anything go by the by.
See, it's interesting because he did collaborate with people all the time, all his career. Later, as we'll come to, he formed Heaven and Hell. I suspect that in the 90s, there was a movement by a lawyer or two, and this is only a suspicion, everyone, all right? Don't sue me, that you were proven to own a band if you put an album out which had your name on it, right? So look at Black Sabbath. You've got Black Sabbath featuring Tony Iommi on that record, which was it, the Seventh Star? Is that that one? Another one?
It was essentially an Iommi solo album, which, in fairness, I think Don Arden, who'd become involved again, decided would sell more copies if it was marketed as a Black Sabbath album.
I mean, mad as a box of frogs. You know, and then Ronnie did this thing. Maybe there's some legal nuance that you and I are aware of and couldn't possibly comment on, even if we did. Anyway, well, I was going to leap forward a little bit and talk about Heaven and Hell when he came back and formed Sabbath, because Ozzy was either not willing or unavailable to form Sabbath with Tony and Geezer.
Well, I can throw some light on that.
Please, would you? That's why I employ you, mate.
They came back together as Black Sabbath. That's what they did. And the reason Ozzy wasn't involved is because Ozzy wasn't involved. You can't have Ronnie and Ozzy in the band. And as Ozzy always used to joke, after he left, Black Sabbath became Geezer and the Three Italians. Because after Bill Ward bailed out, he was replaced by Vinnie Appice. Mm, So you've got Ronnie Dio, Vinnie Appice, Tony Iommi. Hey, Tony! Meet Ronnie! He's the boss. And the idea was to get back the Heaven and Hell era of the band. Mm. At that point, Black Sabbath was a slightly moribund concept. Ozzy still had a huge solo career. Mm. But what had happened, which nobody knew, was that back in the mid-90s, and Sharon Osbourne told me this herself, there had been an occasion, which we won't go into, but there had been an occasion where Sharon had the opportunity, shall we say, to take over the ownership of the name Black Sabbath.
Yes.
Tony Iommi actually gave that over to her. Hmm. And so, although she owns the name, you know, Ozzy and Sabbath had done this farewell thing in LA in like 90... Something like that. Yeah, yeah. And although they'd made occasional reappearances at Ozfest and things like that, essentially it looked like nothing more would come of it. There certainly wouldn't be an album or anything like that.
Yeah.
Okay, the enterprising record company people come to Iommi, whose own career at this point is totally hit the skids. Mm. He brought a solo album out, had loads of guest stars, contemporary stars, and a bloke from Pantera.
Yeah.
I thought a very good album.
It was.
And it didn't sell doodly squat.
Oh, doesn't it? Ozzy was on that too, wasn't he, on a track?
Anybody you can think, Henry Rollins, they were all there.
Skin from Skunk Anansie.
So Geezer's career is moribund.
Yeah.
Bill's away with the fairies.
Yeah.
And Iommi, principally, is the one struggling for something to do.
Yeah.
And Ronnie. So when the offer comes in, look, well, how about you reform Black Sabbath, the Dio era? So that's Ronnie, Tony, Geezer, and Vinnie Appice.
Yeah.
Because Vinnie Appice had gone on to be Ronnie's drummer in Dio.
Yes.
They got a very nice contract to make an album and tour as Black Sabbath.
I mean, it was a good idea, wasn't it?
It was a great idea.
It was
a great idea. Yeah. I mean, they'd also reconvened in, like, 92. They did one album in 92.
Yeah.
With Ronnie.
Dehumanizer.
Exactly. Mm. But that was the height of grunge in the mid-noughties to late noughties. We're now in the classic rock era.
And people are starting to talk about Sabbath, aren't they? You know, as this shit-hot band, which, of course, they had been.
So there they are, fairly set to go.
Yeah.
And suddenly Sharon Osbourne or representatives thereof make it clear that under no circumstances would they be given permission to tour as Black Sabbath.
Right.
Or to make an album under that name. Hence the idea to call the lineup Heaven and Hell. It snookered them because obviously if they had been Black Sabbath, that would have generated a great deal more interest. But the fact is, we all knew who we were talking about.
Yeah.
And they played those songs and they did them really, really well.
And the new album was good. Better the Devil, the, you know.
Great. That Bible Black was a great track.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That was a really, really good album.
It's a really dark album, actually. It's very, very metal.
That was
in a credible,
in a really credible
modern
way.
Metal way. Yeah, there was nothing nostalgic about it. It was fucking great. I loved it.
And it was better than anything Ozzy had done for about 10 years.
I think
well.
So, yeah.
So, yeah, that's what happened there.
Yeah, OK. And then they toured, of course, and coined it in, I assume, because they played these massive venues with Megadeth and Machine Head and all these bands in support. I thought that was an amazing career move. And actually, that was the last time I saw Ronnie play. I saw him play here in London.
Yeah.
And he was really on it. He was really on form. Did you get to talk to him in that latter part of his career?
I did. I did. I just wanted to add before I mention this, when I did Ronnie's PR in the mid-90s, we touched on that earlier, the whole grunge phenomenon was mega. New metal was around the corner.
Yeah.
And Ronnie came to London to do press and I couldn't get him a single interview with any of the music papers. Not one.
Fucking snob.
Not even Kerrang. Not even Kerrang, which arguably Dio had helped build, you know, from its inception in the 80s. He was one of those, you know, one of the drivers of your cover. You'd put him on the cover and you'd sell more copies.
How did he take this sort of snobbish?
Well, I was really worried because he'd come to London. You know, we had 3 days of press set aside. No press.
Mental, isn't it?
I managed to get a fanzine writer and another friend from the metal press. I don't even remember what he was doing the interview for, but he came and interviewed him. And I just had to be really frank with Ronnie and say, look, I'm really, really sorry. I have really tried. And by then, Ronnie had known me for nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
He knew I'd tried.
Yeah.
But we were both kind of off the radar at that moment.
Yeah.
And he was really nice about it.
That's amazing. I'm glad to hear that.
He was really nice about it. We had a laugh, and then we went out and had an Indian meal and drank lots of ale. And I'm sure it, you know, for a proud man, it would have really hurt him. But he dealt with it like a gentleman.
And he took the high road. So I'm so glad to hear that, because I have a little bit of an emotional connection with Ronnie. Even though I only ever interviewed him once, I had half an hour with him. I pointed out to him in the interview I was doing that the very first LP I was bought in my life when I was 3 years old was The Butterfly Ball, Roger Glover's side project,
right.
Which Ronnie warbles on lavishly, doesn't he? And I told him that, and Ronnie said, that's great, kid. Right, he called me kid. And he was probably, I don't know, 55, and I was probably 30 or something at the time, or 25. But at that moment, I wanted him to be my dad, you know what I mean? And so I had grown up listening to his pipes on those weird songs, frankly, which are neither for children nor for adults. So I'm glad when you say, Mick, that a down period in his career, he was gracious enough to sort of take the flak. And I think that the victory was ultimately his, because people look back on him now as this god, don't they? You know,
absolutely.
With unearthly skills, incredible driving force, really, and all sorts of stuff. You can look back on the dragon slaying and the angry machines and all that, and it's not funny, it's not stupid, it's great because we look back on it so fondly. And he wound up his career, albeit way earlier than anybody would have wanted, with a great album and a great band. And I just think that in the world we move in, which is imperfect and full of complete wankers and failures, this was a person who triumphed. That's how I see it. And I know that's sort of unashamedly cheesy, but that's how I see it when I think of old Ronnie.
I agree with you completely.
Mm.
I think, you know, nobody gets anywhere without luck. You've got to have a big scoop of luck.
Yeah.
At the same time...
Say that in a New Jersey kind of way. You need a big scoop of luck.
You need a scoop of luck. Okay, I don't know what that was, but it wasn't New Jersey.
Edit that out. Big scoop of luck.
A big, rather a large scoop of luck.
Yeah, yeah.
Or as we say in New Jersey...
a big scoop of luck.
There
you go. Your mook.
Yeah, that'll do. Right. That's terrible, but that'll do. So anyway, you need a fair measure of luck.
Yeah.
But more than that, you need fortitude, you need courage, you need balls.
Talent.
You need talent, but talent gets you in the room. That's all it does. You know, after that, it's every man for himself. Some of the most talented musicians I've met in my life never sold a record. Some of the most brilliantly successful rock stars I've worked with you know, have this much talent, as they say on Spinal Tap. I mean, they're really not very talented. Yeah. They just do one thing rather well, and they look good.
Yeah.
They look like rock stars.
Yeah.
They did videos, sold millions. Ronnie transformed Ritchie Blackmore's career after Deep Purple. Ritchie, of course, you know, one of the world's greatest guitarists.
He's a force onto his own, isn't
he? Arguably would have gone on to do something significant anyway. But the fact is, Ronnie, who's who took him to that next place.
Yeah.
Black Sabbath, Ronnie rescued their career.
Yeah.
No mean feat.
Twice, then, arguably, you know, with Heaven and Hell.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then went on to his own career, which was even more spectacularly successful in the 80s than Black Sabbath. So here's a guy who didn't just do it once, didn't just do it twice. He did it at least three times. And then in the 90s, I mean, there were stories when I was looking after Ronnie's PR in the mid-90s where he was doing venues so small in America that the changing room was the toilet. I know. But in a way, I think that brings humility sometimes.
It does. It does, and humanity.
And the last sort of 15 years of his life, whenever I spoke to him, he demonstrated that in spades. I mean, he was very, very, very self-aware. He understood when people made fun or did stuff like that. I think all the great rock stars do. You know, Lemmy knew people made fun of him behind his back. Nobody likes it, but they grow past it, you know.
Yeah, if you've got the emotional sort of girth to deal with it and appreciate it and accept it, that's a big thing. And a rare thing, maybe.
Absolutely. And, and by the end of his life, when I spoke to him, certainly, he was a great guy to talk to. Brilliant company.
Well, we traditionally end these podcasts with a mark out of 5 stars, do we not, for various criteria which we apply to our subject. The first one is taste for excess. And I think, as we've said, Ronnie was not an excessive man, particularly, was he? He liked to, puff on the weed.
In terms of drugs, you mean?
Well, I think we mean generally.
Oh, you mean
I think we mean extroversion, don't we, really? I mean,
I tell you what, Ronnie liked to puff, but he liked his ale, he liked his Indian food.
Well, the three things do go rather well together, I'm told.
He was pretty wholesome, in fact, in that respect.
1 star out of 5, then.
Okay.
All right. His influence? Well, no. And let me just butt in here. Glenn Hughes, who I always mention all the time, told me that he used to have an argument with Ronnie on a regular basis about who had the greatest voice, right? This is true. Ronnie used to say, "You're the best, Glenn, you're the best." Glenn used to say, no, Ronnie, you're the best. And in the end, they reached an agreement, which I love, which is that Ronnie was the voice of metal. Glenneth was the voice of rock. No, it's meaningless because they've both done both things. But, you know, you can imagine these two getting together, you know, having a couple of pints going, yeah.
Do you know what? And I love Glenn. I mean, Glenn's a freak of nature.
He's the man.
His voice is still as good today as it was in Deep Purple
bizarrely,
in the 70s.
Yeah.
However, when you talk about influence, I think Ronnie definitely has the edge because wonderful as Glenn is, apart from his time in Deep Purple, his career has taken so many strange and unexpected turns.
That it has.
And he's hooked up with so many. I was just in LA recently and somebody was playing me tapes of Glenn working with John Sykes, Glenn working with all kinds of people. And each of these tapes was amazing, but nothing really ever came of it.
Yeah.
I think Ronnie, you have to say, had a career that spanned 4 decades. And tell you a quick story. When Ronnie came in once and we were struggling to get him pressed, we were also looking after Ugly Kid Joe, who at that point were hotter than a pistol. And Ronnie was in the office and one of the guys from Ugly Kid Joe came in and I sort of went, "Oh, this is Ronnie." He went, "Ronnie Dio!" And he fell to his knees and he's like, "You rule! Dio rules! You rule!" And he just did the whole "we're not worthy" thing. And I thought, he's taking the pit. No.
No, for real.
No, for real. Ronnie Dio rules.
Do you know, we were talking about The Enemy earlier.
You were.
I mentioned The Enemy.
Yeah.
The only thing I ever wrote for The Enemy was a short piece interviewing the drummer of a band. I can't even fucking remember the name. Some band that young people like, right?
Beatles?
No, it was some, you know...
Stones?
Some sort of guitar-y youths. And one of them was banging on about Ronnie James Dio, and that was why The Enemy asked me to do it, because I was the metal expert who could translate this into a way that Enemy readers would understand. I have a fairly strong feeling that my article is the only time that Ronnie James Dio was mentioned in The Enemy for
about
25 years.
And that's why they went down the shitter.
And that's what killed them. Yeah.
It was one mention of him. They paid a bit more attention to Dio and less to the fucking Morrissey.
That's it, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, let's talk about death as a career move, which our producer always puts on. I think it's a very cynical thing to say, but, you know, it's not like he didn't die young. He wasn't Kurt Cobain, was he? He died in his later years of a tragic disease that was unavoidable. He's not at the 27 Club. It's not really even relevent, is it?
No. I mean, it really isn't.
Edit that out.
Yeah.
His legacy.
Well, the Dio legacy continues to reverberate. I mean, it's, it's there, obviously, in Black Sabbath. It's there in Rainbow. It's there with his own work. It's there in Heaven and Hell.
Oh, and the Devil Horns, of course, that you pioneered yourself.
The Devil Horns, which I didn't pioneer. Ronnie did. And it really grieves me when you see these people like Gene Simmons trying to claim ownership. No, Gene.
Unusual.
I was in the room when Ronnie came up with that one. And I tell you what, I was there the first night on tour when he did it.
Mm-hmm.
And like that, the whole audience did it back.
Oh, I love
and
that
I was completely awestruck. Because I thought, he's going to do this and some people are going to go, well, what's he doing? And no, they immediately did it back.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear.
And I thought, this guy's a genius.
What a moment. What a moment.
Man's a genius.
Fantastic. Mick, what are your views on Ronnie James Dio reappearing in front of audiences as we speak in the form of hologram?
Well, of course, you hear this and you go, oh, for God's sake, that's just wrong on every level. But I saw a clip on YouTube. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very entertaining. And we live in an age where these things are not beyond the pale. This is actually where we now live.
Yeah.
And you look at Elvis with the Philharmonic Orchestra.
Yeah.
They're talking about doing a Michael Jackson tour.
And Prince has been mentioned.
Absolutely. And if you go and see these tribute bands, the best ones of which can be extremely entertaining
absolutely.
And fun to see.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'd rather see the Australian Pink Floyd than the real Pink Floyd at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of actually seeing Ronnie James Dio in his heyday with that voice and, of course, throwing those horns, although he wouldn't have put it that way,
no.
with a live band, I don't rule that out at all. I mean, that to me is a night out. I could see you and me, Joel, going to that to pay fealty to the mighty Dio and the fact that he will always live on forever.
And the question is, that brings everyone down, is would he have minded? Would he have been bothered if he'd known?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't think so. I think that's Ronnie lived for the greater glory of Ronnie and his Titanic music. I mean, in fairness, his music is timeless.
Yeah.
There aren't any Lindrums on his 80s stuff.
No.
And
yeah.
the only time he tried to plug slightly more into the musical zeitgeist, as it were, the rock zeitgeist, was in the 90s.
Yeah.
But then everybody was. Iron Maiden tried to.
Yeah,
Def Leppard tried to.
Mm-hmm.
Even Led Zeppelin cut their hair when punk came along.
Yep.
But apart from that, I mean, he stayed true to himself and he knew exactly who he was and what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
And he was utterly shameless and awesome about the whole thing.
I have no problem with it myself. You know, if a great artist like that can be translated into digital form and therefore be immortal in the banks of a server somewhere, I have no problem with it. You know, you know perfectly well you're not being sold the real thing. You know what you're going to see. You can't complain about it. You don't have to go and see it. Yeah, I'm all for it myself. And I feel sorry for those who didn't see The Great Man in the Flesh. But at least there's a simulacrum of it available.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe they could do one of the dragon.
Denzel.
Yeah, why not? A VR Denzel.
Be easier than remaking the thing.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, that's pretty much all we're going to say about the great Ronnie James Dio today. Well, although, frankly, we could sit here and talk for many more hours about him, couldn't we?
We could.
I'm so glad you knew him well, Mick. I feel very privileged that I got to have a brief moment with him because, as I said earlier, you know, quite an emotional connection for me. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We really appreciate you tuning in to hearing us talk about these things. Do get in touch with us via the Facebook page or the Twitter feed or wherever you heard this from. And I'd like to trailer episode number 3, Mick, if you don't mind.
Yes.
Without giving away who the subject might or might not be. Our producer, Seven Digital, by the way, huge thanks to Seven Digital. Wonderful people, fragrant people who produce the show.
Are we going to name our producer?
Yeah, his name's Ian Callahan.
Yeah, and he's the most beautiful guy.
He's great. I'm looking at him now.
I'd like to thank
him. He's come up with this great thing. He says, now, this is the link to the next chat we're going to be talking about in episode 3.
Yeah.
Now, Dio said, we rock. Our next subject was a little bit more verbose because he added the words, will and you. To the words we rock. And I'm sure, people, you can figure that one out for yourself. Now, on that bombshell, I would like to say thank you so much, everyone. And it's a big goodbye from Mick.
Goodbye.
And it's a big goodbye from me. Goodbye! If you enjoyed this, then please rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast. And be sure to share it on social media.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.